prostatically, but he was too tired to be wary of the dust. "Wish I had a headband," he said to himself as he tried to blink the sweat out of his eyes. He didn't want to look at the thermometer on his forearm panel, didn't want to know how hot it really was. The sun was broiling him. He knew that, and it was enough. The bleak plain stretched in every direction around him, nothing but rocks and dusty regolith and more rocks. In his helmet earphones he heard nothing but the precisely timed beep of his suit radio's plaintive call to the GPS satellites that were not there to answer. "Like a Chinese water torture," Paul groused. "Beep, then wait, and then another beep. Where the fuck's the answering signal? At least one of the pissing satellites ought to be in range by now." But he heard only his suit radio's patient, maddening call signal. 1 foot in front of the other, Paul told himself as he pushed along. Just keep putting 1 foot in front of the other, and you'll get there sooner or later. His vision blurred, and without thinking he wiped at his helmet visor. A film of gray smeared across the visor. "Oh, crap, just what I need," Paul grumbled to himself. The upper half of the visor was covered with dust. He had to peer through the lower half to see where he was going. Without stopping, he fumbled in the pocket on the right thigh of his suit for an electrostatic cloth. "Got to be one in there," he said to himself. "If they kept the suit supplies topped off, if the cloth hasn't already been saturated." It was almost impossible to feel anything as thin as the cloth with his gloves on, but at last Paul pulled a bright green square from the pocket. He held it up in front of his visor and inspected it as best he could through the smear of dust. "Looks good enough." Most of it was still bright green, although one corner of the cloth had turned gray. It had been used before. Carefully folding the cloth so that the gray, used section was out of the way, Paul wiped slowly at his visor. It seemed to help, but only a little. Ought to have windshield wipers on the damned helmets, he thought. The cloth was not doing the job it should have done. Must have lost some of its electrostatic charge while it was sitting in the pocket. It's been used before, too. Christ, it's just not working. The gray smear seemed a bit thinner now, not as opaque. Paul could see through it as if it were a frosted window. Blurry shapes and shadows, not much more. He refolded the cloth and tried again. No improvement. All he managed to do was to smear the dust a little further across his visor. In disgust, he tossed the cloth away. It soared like a rigid sheet of thin metal in the airlessness of the moon, spinning lazily until it sailed out of his range of vision. "Okay," Paul muttered. "Now we play pissin' blind man's bluff all the way to the next tempo." Then he heard a sudden chatter of beeps in his earphones, the signal from a GPS satellite. Grinning, Paul remembered that blind people often gain a remarkable sense of hearing. "I'll play it by ear," he said aloud, and began to laugh wildly at his pun. But he needed to look at the displays on his forearm panel to make sense of the GPS navigational signal. His laughter died as he squinted through the dust filming his visor. If he was reading the instruments correctly, he had drifted more than 6 miles off his course to the next underground shelter. San Jose. The manager of the nanotech division was barely out of her 30s, young and intense and obviously nervous, yet she seemed to be the oldest person that Paul could see anywhere in the plant. Her skirted suit of charcoal gray looked as if she hadn't worn it since her first job interview. She looked uncomfortable in it, as if she longed to be in a t-shirt and jeans, as almost everyone else was. Paul felt like an old and stuffy grandfather in his light whipcord slacks and tan sports jacket. "Good thing I didn't wear a tie," he said to himself. "These kids would think I came from Mars."
"Mr. Masterson was here last week, you know," the manager was saying, "and he said he was very satisfied with the progress we've made in the past 6 months."
"So that's it," Paul realized as they looked through the thick window into a clean room where white-smocked technicians were bent over laboratory benches. Paul saw that the techs wore white caps over their heads and even had white booties over their shoes. Or sandals, he thought, glancing at the manager's bare, unpainted toes. "Look," he said to her, I'm not here to swing a hatchet, you know. The manager's expression clearly said she didn't believe Paul. The ID badge pinned to her jacket said Chris Cardenas. She didn't look Hispanic, though. To Paul, she looked like a California surfer chick, an attractive kid with softly curled sandy hair, a swimmer's broad shoulders, wide, sincere cornflower blue eyes and a deep tan, and enough brains in her head to rise to the top of this very competitive high-tech division. Making a smile for her, Paul explained, "You've probably heard that Greg Masterson and I are enemies, haven't you?" She nodded warily. "Well, even if we are, that doesn't mean I want to kill this division just because he's backing it. From what I can see, you're doing a good job here." Cardenas seemed to be holding her breath, waiting for the other shoe to drop. "What I'd like to know," Paul went on, "is whether or not you're at a stage of development where we can try some practical tests of nanotechnology." "We were ready to try clinical tests of tumor killers," Cardenas said, "but the government ruled that anything intended to go inside human patients has to go through the FDA's approval procedure, and that takes years." "I know," Paul said. Washington's decision had set the entire nanotechnology industry into a tailspin. It wiped out any hope of profitability for this division for years to come. "I can show you the animal tests we've done," Cardenas said, starting down the corridor. "We can destroy tumors with better than 80% efficiency, and no collateral damage to healthy tissue, you know." Following her, Paul said, "In animals." She nodded vigorously. "Pigs, rhesus monkeys, even chimps. There's no reason why the bugs shouldn't work just as well in humans. There's just no sense to the government's restrictions." With a world-weary shrug, Paul said, "I agree, but they've made their decision, and we've got to live with it." "Or die with it," he added silently. "It's stupid," Cardenas insisted. "I was wondering, though, could you adapt nanotechnology to other applications?"
"Oh, sure," she said easily, pronouncing the word sure.
They had reached a set of big double doors. Cardenas pushed one open and they stepped through into a large room filled with animal cages. The walls and floor were tiled in white. The smell of animal fur and excrement was enough to make Paul's eyes water.
"Careful," Cardenas warned. "These floor tiles get kind of slick, you know. The handlers have to wash them down a lot."
"I'll bet," said Paul. As she led Paul past a row of cages filled with hairless lab rats, Cardenas told him, "We're already adapting what we've developed here for other applications." One of the monkeys yipped at them, and within half a second all of them were howling and shrieking. The din was overpowering, echoing off the tiled walls like shockwaves pounding on Paul's ears. Looking worried, Cardenas shouted over the noise,
"Maybe we'd better go someplace quieter."
"Amen to that," Paul yelled back.
Once they were out in the corridor again, with the heavy doors muffling most of the noise, Cardenas said,
"Just about every one of those monkeys had cancerous tumors. You know, really nasty carcinomas and stuff like that. The nanobugs found them inside their bodies and disassembled them molecule by molecule."
"So once you finally get FDA approval, this division ought to be worth a good-sized fortune," Paul said reassuringly.
"For sure."
"In the meantime, though," Paul let the thought dangle in the air between them.
"In the meantime,"
she said, leading him farther down the corridor,
"we're trying to spin off the medical work into toxic waste cleanup."
"You can program the bugs to eat toxic wastes?" Cardenas nodded vigorously.
"It's pretty simple, really, compared to the tumor work. They can go through a waste dump, find the molecules you want to get rid of, and take them apart. Nothing left but carbon dioxide, water, and pure elements which you can recycle."
"Sounds good," Paul said.
"We're trying to get the state environmental agency to participate in a demonstration we've set up."
"Not the federal EPA?" Cardenas wrinkled her nose.
"The feds are real assholes. My strategy is to get the state environmental guys on our side and let them convince the feds."
Paul remembered the first man he had worked for when he had started at Masterson Aerospace. "Make the customer a party to the crime," he had advised. "Get them on your side and they'll do half your work for you." His respect for Cardenas went up a notch. She stopped at a locked door with a restricted access sign over it.
"At least this area will be quieter than the animal pens."
A few taps of the electronic lock and the door swung open. Paul followed her into a small, stuffy, windowless room crammed with consoles and instrumentation. The only lights came from the display screens on the console.